dressed right now to play some part. Or perhaps it had been the expression on Wiley's face when Simon first stumbled across him down in the woods. There was no grief emanating from Wiley Crevalle. Of course, all the clichés apply here. People grieve in their own way. Just because you can't see a man is hurting doesn't mean he isn't. He could be putting on a brave face. But they all rang hollow. Enid had described her husband as theatrical. Simon got that now, as if everything he did was part of an act, including his feelings. That little boy, living alone with the man who claimed to be his father. Simon tried to hold back his imagination, but it became a bucking horse, running wild, running toward the worst thoughts, the most awful, depraved scenarios. They can't be true, Simon told himself. And yet... I'll get a court order. For what? Wiley asked, spreading his hands, the picture now of pure innocence. Parentage. Seriously? That damned creepy smile. Aaron was cremated. I can find his DNA in other ways. Doubtful. And even if you could somehow get his DNA and mine, it would show that I'm his father. You're lying. Am I? He's enjoying this, Simon thought. And just for the sake of a fun mental exercise, suppose you did run the test, and suppose it showed I wasn't Aaron's biological father. What would that prove? Simon said nothing. Maybe his mother cheated on me. What difference could that make all these years later? The test wouldn't show that, of course. This is all a hypothetical. I was Aaron's father, but what do you think you'd be able to prove? Wiley took two steps toward Simon. My son was a drug dealer living with your junkie daughter in the Bronx. That's where he was murdered. Whatever gossip Enid told you, you have to see that his murder has nothing to do with his childhood. That made sense, of course. On the surface, there was no way to argue with any of that. There was not a scintilla of evidence that linked whatever potential awfulness had occurred to a young boy in this very inn and his bloody murder decades later in that Bronx tenement. And yet... Simon shifted gears. When did Aaron start getting into drugs? The oily smile was back. Maybe you should ask Enid about that. When did he move away? When did who move away? Who are we talking about? Aaron. Another smile. Christ, he was really enjoying this. Enid didn't tell you? Tell me what? Aaron didn't move away. What are you talking about? Enid has a place. It's a sort of club. What about it? There's an apartment off the back, Wiley said. Aaron lived there. Until when? I wouldn't really know. Aaron and I, we were estranged. Simon tried to follow this. So, when did he move near Lanford College? What are you talking about? He moved there. I think Aaron was working at a club when he met Paige. Wiley actually laughed out loud now. Ha! Who told you that? Now Simon felt the chill again. You think they met in Lanford? They didn't? No. Where then? Here. He nodded at the look of surprise on Simon's face. Paige came here.
To the inn?
Yes. Did you see her?
I did.
Now the laugh was gone, the smile falling away. His voice turned grave.
I also saw her after.
After what?
After she'd been with Aaron for a few months. The difference, what he did to her.
Wiley Crevalle stopped, shook his head.
If you did harm my son, I almost can't blame you. I can only tell you that I'm sorry.
Bullshit. He wasn't sorry. This was all an act. What did Paige want? Simon asked. When she came here.
What do you think?
I have no idea.
She wanted to meet Aaron.
It made no sense. Why would Paige, a seemingly happy college freshman, come here looking for a scumbag like Aaron Crevalle? How would his daughter even know who he was? Had they met earlier? Not according to Wiley Crevalle. Paige had specifically come to the inn seeking to meet Aaron. Did she come to him to score drugs? It also seemed a long shot. Driving this distance to score drugs, hours from Lanford College, seemed patently ridiculous. Did Aaron and Paige meet online in some way? This seemed most likely. They met online, and Paige drove up here to meet in person, but how? Why? How did their paths cross? Paige didn't seem like the type for online dating or Tinder or any of that. Or even if she was, even if Simon was being naive about his own daughter, couldn't she hook up with someone closer to her school? It made no sense. Could Wiley be lying about Paige coming to the inn? Could he be trying to muddy the waters and distract from what Enid had told Simon about Aaron's parentage? Simon didn't think so. Wiley Corval was a sleazebag and untrustworthy and maybe, no, probably worse. But his words about Paige coming here to meet Aaron had that odd yet unmistakable scent of truth. Simon drove back to Enid's club, but she was gone. He hit Yvonne's speed dial. Yvonne answered on the first ring. If there's a change, I'll call you. No change at all? None. And the doctors? Nothing new. Simon closed his eyes. I spent the day making calls, Yvonne said. To whom? Well-connected friends. I wanted to make sure we have the absolute best doctors on this. And, he asked. And we do. Fill me in on your visit to the inn. He did. When he finished, Yvonne simply said, Holy shit. I know. So where do you go next? I'm not sure. Yeah, you are, Yvonne said. She knew him too well. Something at that college changed Paige, he said. I agree. Simon? Yes? Call me in 3 hours. I want to know you arrived at Lanford safely. Chapter 19. That weekend, Eileen Vaughn told Simon, Paige borrowed my car. They sat in the four-person common room with cathedral ceiling. The dorm's oversized bay window looked out over a Lanford College quad dripping so green, it might as well have been a still-wet painting. Eileen Vaughn had been Paige's freshman year roommate. On Paige's first day of college, when Simon, Ingrid, Sam, and Anya had all brought her to this campus brimming with hope, Eileen Vaughn had been the first to greet them. Eileen was smart and friendly and, on the surface at least, seemed to be the perfect roommate. Simon had taken her phone number, just in case, for emergency purposes only, which is why he still had it now. Simon and Ingrid had left Lanford College that day on such a high. Squinting into the campus sun, they'd held hands as they walked back to the car, even as Sam grumbled about his parents' gross PDA, public display of affection, and Anya scoffed out an, ugh, can you not? Back in the car, Simon had reminisced about his own college years, how he'd lived in a four-person suite like the one he was in now, but not like this one. Simon's had been littered with empty pizza boxes and emptier beer cans, decorated an early American pub crawl, while Eileen Vaughn's suite looked like something out of an IKEA catalog, all pale woods and real furniture and freshly vacuumed throw carpets. There was nothing ironic or collegey on the walls, no decorative bongs or Che posters or, heck, posters of any kind, favoring instead handcrafted tapestries with mild Buddhist designs or geometric patterns. The whole effect was less true collegiate and more model showroom, the dorm you use to sway prospective students and more their parents during campus visits. Had Paige ever done that before? Simon asked Eileen. Barred my car? Never. She told me she didn't like to drive. It was more than that, Simon thought. Paige didn't know how to drive, not really. She'd managed to get her license after taking lessons from a driving school in Fort Lee, but because they lived in Manhattan, she never drove. You know how Paige was, Eileen continued, not realizing how the was rather than is struck him deep in the chest. It was appropriate, of course. Paige was a was in terms of this campus and probably Eileen's life. But as he looked at this lovely, healthy-looking girl, yes, he should call her a woman, but right now he only saw Eileen as a girl like his daughter. There was a deep, heavy thud in his heart, reminding him that his daughter should be there, occupying one of the suite's four bedrooms with a box spring on the floor and a desk with a gooseneck lamp. Eileen said, even if Paige had to get something at the supermarket or CVS, she'd ask me to drive instead.
So it must have surprised you when Paige asked to borrow the car.
Eileen wore jeans and a dark gray cable-knit sweater with a turtleneck. Her long reddish hair was parted in the middle and hung down behind her shoulders. Her eyes were big and indigo blue, and she just reeked of youth and college and possibilities. And it killed him. Her voice was hesitant.
It did.
You seem unsure.
Can I ask you something, Mr. Green?
He was going to correct her and tell her to call him Simon, but the formality felt somehow right here. She was his daughter's friend. He was asking about his daughter.
Of course. Why now?
Pardon?
This was a long time ago. What happened with Paige? I know I agreed to see you, but this wasn't really easy for me either.
What wasn't easy?
What happened with Paige? Here, I mean, at Lanford. We had that small room, the two of us, and, I don't know, we connected. She was my best friend right away. I'm an only child. I don't want to make too much of this, but Paige was like a sister to me. And then...
Eileen had been hurt, and she'd recovered, and now Simon was ripping open the stitches. He felt bad about that. But Eileen was young, and 30 minutes after he walked out the door, she'd go to a class, or one of her roommates would get her for dinner in the Cushman cafeteria, and then they'd study at the elders' library and probably hit a dorm party, and those wounds would be back sealed up tight.
What happened? Simon asked.
Paige changed.
No hesitation. Why?
I don't know.
He tried to think how to approach this.
When?
It was toward the end of her first semester. After this trip with your car.
Yes. Well, no. Something was off even before then.
Simon leaned forward a little, making sure to keep away from her personal space.
How long before?
I'm not sure. It's hard to remember. It's just that...
He nodded for her to go on.
When Paige asked to borrow the car, I remember feeling weird about it. Not just because it was out of character, but because she'd been distant lately.
Any idea why?
No. I was hurt. I was maybe a little angry with her about it.
Eileen looked up. I should have reached out to her instead, you know, instead of getting all hurt about it, making it all about me. Maybe if I'd been a good friend. None of this is on you, Eileen. She didn't seem convinced.
Could Paige have been taking drugs? Simon asked.
You mean before she met Aaron?
One theory is that Paige was doing drugs already, so Aaron might have been a source or something.
Eileen considered that. I don't think so, for one thing. I know this is a college campus and drugs are supposed to be rampant, but that's not really how it is here. I wouldn't even know where to buy anything stronger than weed.
Maybe that was it, Simon said.
What?
Maybe Paige wanted to buy something stronger.
So she went to Aaron?
It's one theory.
Eileen wasn't buying it. Paige didn't even smoke weed. I don't mean to make her sound like some kind of priss. She drank and stuff, but I never saw her stoned before, or high, or whatever you want to call it. The first time I saw her like that was after she met Aaron.
So it comes back to the same thing, Simon said.
Why did Paige borrow your car? Why did she drive to this quiet corner of Connecticut?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
You said she was different?
Yes.
How about her other friends?
I think...
Her gaze traveled up and to the left.
Yes, looking back on it, I think Paige just kind of withdrew from all of us. One of our friends, Judy Siskind. Do you know her?
No.
Judy's one of my suite mates now. She's at a lacrosse game at Bowdoin, or I'd ask her to explain. Anyway, I don't think this is it, but Judy thought maybe something had happened to her at a frat party.
Simon felt a cold jolt run through him.
What do you mean happened to her?
We talk a lot about sexual assault on campus here.
A lot. I'm not saying too much. We really need it, but I think Judy sort of has it on the brain now.
So when someone becomes withdrawn, it's kind of all we see. I remember one night Judy confronting Paige about it, about some guy who Judy thought was bothering Paige.
What guy?
I don't know. They didn't say a name.
And this was before Aaron?
Yes. How did Paige react?
She said that it had nothing to do with any of that.
Did she say what it did have to do with?
Eileen hesitated, turned away.
Eileen?
Did she say something else?
Yes.
What?
I think Paige was just trying to deflect, to get us off her back.
What did she say?
She said,
Eileen turned back, met Simon's eyes,
that there were problems at home.
Simon blinked and leaned back, taking the blow. He hadn't been expecting that.
What kind of problems at home?
Paige wouldn't elaborate.
No clue at all.
I thought, well, with what happened after, with Aaron and the drugs and everything, I thought maybe you and Dr. Green were having problems.
We weren't.
Oh. Simon's mind swirled. Problems at home. He tried to piece it together. It wasn't the marriage. He and Ingrid were good, better than ever, actually. It wasn't financial. Her parents were both at the height of their careers and earning power. How about Paige's siblings? Nothing strange, nothing that he could remember.
There had been a minor drama with Sam's science teacher, but no. That had been the year before, and that wouldn't warrant a problems-at-home comment.
Unless something had been going on that Simon didn't know about.
But even if that were the case, even if Paige imagined or saw some real problem with something back home with her family, how had that led her to drive to Connecticut and Aaron?
He asked Eileen that.
I'm sorry, Mr. Green. I don't know.
Eileen Vaughn glanced at her mobile phone the way someone older might glance at their watch. She shifted on the couch, her body language suddenly all wrong, and Simon knew that he was losing her.
I have a class soon, she said.
Eileen?
Yes?
Aaron's been murdered.
Her eyes widened.
Paige has run off.
Run off?
She's missing. And now I think whoever killed Aaron is after her, too.
I don't understand. Why?
I don't know. But I think whatever brought them together, whatever made Paige seek Aaron out, is responsible. That's why I need your help. I need to figure out what happened to her on this campus that made her borrow your car and go to Aaron.
I don't know.
I get that. And I get that you just want me to leave, but I'm asking you for your help.
Help how?
Start from the beginning. Tell me everything that happened, no matter how insignificant it might seem.
Paige became a try-hard, Eileen Vaughn told him.
Oh, what?
A try-hard, Eileen repeated. You know how during orientation week they tell you that you can be all you want to be, that this is your chance to start anew and take advantage of all the opportunities?
Simon nodded.
Paige took that to heart.
Isn't that a good thing?
I thought she was overdoing it.
She wanted to be in a play. She tried out for 2 a cappella groups. There's this club on campus of science nerds who build robots. She joined that. She ran for a freshman judiciary seat and won. She got obsessed with the Family Tree Club, which hooked up with our genetics class to figure out where you're from and all that. She also wanted to write a play. Looking back on it, it was all too much. She was driving herself too hard.
Did she have any boyfriends?
No one serious.
The guy your lacrosse roommate mentioned.
I don't know anything about that. I'll text Judy if you like.
Please.
Eileen took out her phone, her fingers dancing on the screen. She nodded when it was done.
How about her academics? Simon asked. What classes was she taking?
A father should know that, of course, but before all this, Simon had prided himself on not being one of those helicopter parents. He didn't know her classes, even in high school. Some parents checked an online program called Skyward every day to make sure their child did their homework or was keeping up with their grades. Simon didn't even know how to log on. He had smugly thought back then that that made him a better father.
Stay out of the way. Trust your child.
And it had been easy with Paige. She was self-driven. She excelled. Ah, what satisfaction Simon had felt back then. What foolish superiority over those overbearing and over-involved parents he'd felt
bragging that he didn't even know his Skyward password, like that asshole at the party who brags about not owning a television. What arrogance before the fall. Eileen wrote down the names of Paige's classes and the professors who taught them. She handed him the slip of paper and said, "I really have to go now. Do you mind if I walk with you?" She said that would be fine, but she said it grudgingly. Simon read the class list as they headed for the door. "Does anything jump out at you?" "Not really. Most of the classes were pretty big. I don't think the professors will really remember her. The only exception would be Professor Van de Beek." They started across that bright green quad. "What did Van de Beek teach?" "That genetics class I told you about. Where can I find him?" Still walking, Eileen pecked something out on her mobile phone. "Here, this is him." She handed him the phone. Professor Louis Van de Beek was young, probably not yet 30, and, not to be that father, he looked like the kind of professor that made young co-eds swoon. His so black its blue hair was a touch too long, his skin a little too waxy. He had good teeth, a nice smile. He wore a tight black t-shirt in the picture, his toned arms folded over his chest. What the hell happened to professors with tweed sport coats? Under his portrait it read, "Professor of Biological Science." It also listed his office address at Clark House, his email address, his website, and finally, the classes he taught, including Introduction to Genetics and Genealogy. "You said he was an exception."
"Yes."
"Why?" Simon asked. "For one thing, genetics and genealogy was a small class," she said, "so we got to know the professor pretty well. But for Paige, he was something more."
"Like what?"
"Professor Van de Beek ran that family tree club I told you she got obsessed with. I know she visited him during office hours. A lot." Simon frowned again. Eileen must have spotted it.
"Oh, no, nothing like that."
"Okay."
"When Paige got here, she didn't know what to major in. Like the rest of us. You knew that, right?"
He nodded. He and Ingrid had encouraged that. No need to lock yourself down, they told her. "Explore, try new things. You'll find your passion."
Paige talked a lot about her mom and her job. Then she quickly added, "Not that she didn't talk about you, too, Mr. Green. I mean, I think she found your job interesting, too."
"It's okay, Eileen."
"Anyway, I think she sort of hero-worshipped her mom. Professor Van de Beek is also the freshman counselor for students who want to go into medicine." Simon swallowed. "Paige wanted to be a physician?"
"Yeah, I think so."
The revelation crushed him anew. Paige had wanted to be a doctor, like her mother. "Anyway," Eileen continued, "I don't think this has anything to do with her meeting Aaron, but Professor Van de Beek was a big part of her life here." They crossed in front of Ratner Dormitory, where Paige and Eileen had lived freshman year, walking right across the spot where Simon had hugged his daughter goodbye a lifetime ago. The painful hits just kept coming. When Eileen spotted some friends in front of the Isherwood building, she told Simon that her class was inside and bid him a quick goodbye. He waved as she left and then headed over to Clark House. When he entered the front foyer, an older woman with a face that had seen it all before the Eisenhower administration sat behind the desk and scowled at him. A small nameplate read, "Mrs. Dinsmore," no first name.
"May I help you?"
Mrs. Dinsmore said in a voice that indicated any help would come very reluctantly. "I'm looking for Professor Van de Beek."
"You won't find him."
"Pardon?"
"Professor Van de Beek is on sabbatical."
"Since when?"
"I'm not at liberty to answer any additional questions on the matter."
"Is he around or is he traveling?" Mrs. Dinsmore had a pair of glasses on a chain around her neck. She put them on now and frowned with even more disapproval.
"What part of not at liberty to answer did you find confusing?"
Simon had Louis Van de Beek's email from that web directory. That seemed the more prudent way to go.
"You've been a delight, thank you."
"I aim to please," Mrs. Dinsmore replied, head down, writing something down. Simon headed back toward his car. He called Yvonne and heard yet again how nothing with Ingrid's condition had changed. He wanted to ask a million questions, but an odd memory came to him. Early in his relationship with Ingrid, Simon worried about the overseas markets and political upheaval and upcoming earnings reports. Anything that could affect his clients' portfolios. That was natural enough, part of the job on the surface, but it actually made him a less focused and less effective financial analyst. The Serenity Prayer, Ingrid had told him one night. She'd been sitting at the computer wearing one of his dress shirts, her back to him.
What?
He came up behind her and rested his hands on his beautiful wife's shoulders. The printer whirred. She reached for a sheet of paper and handed it to him. Put this on your desk, she said. He should have been familiar with the prayer, of course, but he wasn't. He read it, and, odd as this sounds, it changed his life almost immediately.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference.
No, Simon wasn't religious in the least, and the prayer was short and obvious. Yet it resonated, and more than that, it resonated with Ingrid. He couldn't change Ingrid's condition. She was comatose in a hospital, the pain of that constant and ripping. But he had to let it go because it was foolhardy to think he could change that fact now. He couldn't. So accept that. Let it go. Change the things that he could. Like finding his daughter. When Simon reached his car, he called Elena Ramirez.
Anything? He asked.
You first.
Paige came to Aaron, not the other way around. I always thought that they met near Lanford College, but she sought him out.
So she knew him before, somehow. Probably met online, a dating app or something.
Why would she have been on a dating app? Why is anyone? She's a college freshman, all caught up in her studies and new friends. And that's not my dad goggles talking.
Dad goggles?
You know, bias, seeing your kids through dad goggles.
Oh, right.
That was what Paige was like, according to her roommate, not me.
Did you talk to the guy at the tattoo parlor yet?
Damien Gorse, stick with me first, Simon. Is there anything else you think I should know?
Just something really weird about Aaron's upbringing, or his parentage, anyway.
Tell me.
So Simon filled her in on the story Enid told him about Aaron and Wiley's tale of a dead Italian mother. When he finished, there was silence on the other end of the phone. Then he heard her tapping on a keyboard.
Elena?
I'm trying to Google photographs of Aaron and his father.
Why?
There was a pause.
I don't see any. I see some of the father at the inn, Wiley.
Why, what's up?
This is going to sound weird, she began.
But?
But you've seen both Aaron and Wiley in person.
Yes.
Do you think they're father and son? I mean, biologically?
No. Simon said it that fast, without really processing his response. I mean, look, I don't know. Something is off. Why?
It might be nothing.
But?
But Henry Thorpe was adopted, Elena said. So was Damien Gorse.
Simon felt a chill, but he still said, you're reaching.
I know.
Paige wasn't adopted.
I know that, too.
Elena?
Yes?
What did Damien Gorse tell you?
Nothing, Simon.
Gorse is dead. Someone murdered him, too. Chapter 20 Ash always tried to be prepared. There were fresh clothes in the car for both of them. They managed to change on the move and dumped the old clothes in a charity bin behind a Whole Foods near the New York State border. At a Rite Aid, Dee Dee, donning a baseball cap, bought 10 items, but only two really mattered, hair dye and a scissors. He didn't go in with her. There were cameras everywhere. Let them look for a lone woman or lone man. Confuse them. Don't stay any place too long. Dee Dee thought she could just color her hair in the Rite Aid bathroom. Ash told her that would be a mistake. Keep moving. Don't give them anything to go on. They drove another 10 miles and found an old school gas station. Poorer CCTV, Ash figured. Dee Dee headed into the bathroom wearing the baseball cap. Using the newly brought scissors, she sawed off the long blonde braid and cropped her hair close. Then she flushed the cut hair down the toilet.
She dyed the shorter locks a subtle auburn, nothing too striking, and put the cap back on her head. Ash had told her, always walk with your head tilted down. CCTV cameras shot from above, always. So wear a cap with a bill and keep your eyes on the ground. Sometimes, depending on the weather, sunglasses were a good idea. Other times, they drew the wrong kind of attention.
This is overkill, Dee Dee said.
Probably. But she didn't argue. And if Dee Dee really had an issue with his precautions, she'd argue. Once they were back on the road, Dee Dee took off the cap and mussed her hair with her hand.
How do I look?
He risked a look and felt the kaboom in his heart. Dee Dee pulled her knees up to her chest and fell asleep in the seat next to him. Ash kept sneaking glances at her. At a red light, he rolled up a shirt he'd kept in the back seat and placed it between her head and the car door, just to make sure she was comfortable and didn't hurt herself. 3 hours later, when she woke up, Dee Dee said,
I need to pee.
Ash pulled off at the next rest stop. They put on baseball caps. Ash bought some chicken fingers and fries to go. When they got back on the highway, Dee Dee asked,
Where are we headed?
We don't know what the cops have on you.
That's not an answer to my question, Ash.
You know where we're going, he said. Dee Dee did not reply. I know it's near the Vermont border, Ash said, but I don't know the exact location. You'll have to direct me.
They won't let you in. No outsiders.
Got it. Especially men. Ash rolled his eyes. Gee, that seems normal.
That's the rules. No outside men in Truth Haven.
I don't have to go in, Dee. I just need to drop you off.
Why?
You know why.
You think it's not safe for me anymore.
Bingo.
But it's not up to you to decide what's safe, she said. It's not up to me either.
Don't tell me, Ash said. It's in God's hands.
She smiled at him.
It was, as always, even with the strange hair color and new cut, beatific.
The smile struck his heart with a gentle boom. It's not just God. It's the truth.
And who tells you the truth?
For those who can never understand, it's easiest to call him God.
He talks to you?
Via his personage on Earth.
Ash had studied up on the nonsense of her cult. That would be Caspar Vartage.
God made his choice.
Vartage is a con man.
The devil doesn't want the truth to flourish. The devil dies in truth's light.
So Vartage's jail time?
That's where he was told the truth. In solitary, after they beat him and tortured him. Now when the media and outsiders speak ill of him, it is because they are trying to silence the truth.
Ash shook his head. Pointless.
It's the second exit after the Vermont border, she said.
Ash flipped the station. The 70s classic, Hey, St. Peter, by Flash and the Pan, came on the radio. Ash had to smile. In the song, a man arrives at the gates of heaven and pleads for St. Peter to let him in, because living in New York City means he's already done his time in hell.
Do you have music at the compound? Ash asked. We call it Truth Haven.
Dee Dee.
Yes, we have music. Many of our members are talented musicians. They write their own songs.
You don't have outside music.
That wouldn't spread the truth, Ash.
One of Vartage's rules.
Please don't use his before name.
His before name?
Yes, it's forbidden.
Before name, he said again. You mean like you're now Holly?
Yes.
Did he give you that name?
The Truth Council did.
Who makes up the Truth Council?
The Truth, the Volunteer, the Visitor.
Three people.
Yes.
All men?
Yes.
Like the Trinity.
She turned toward him. Nothing like the Trinity.
No reason to get into that, he thought.
I assume the Truth is Caspar Vartage. He is, yes.
And the other two?
They are the offspring of the Truth. They were born and raised in the Haven.
His sons, you mean?
It's not like that, but for your purposes, yes.
My purposes.
You wouldn't understand, Ash.
Another line from every cult. He held up a hand before she could admonish him. And what happens if you question the truth?
Truth is truth, by definition. Anything else is a lie.
Wow.
So everything your leader says is gospel. Can the lion not be a lion? He's the truth.
How can what he says not be true? Ash shook his head as they crossed into Vermont. He kept sneaking glances at her. Dee Dee. She closed her eyes. Do you really want me to call you Holly? No, she said. It's okay. When I'm not in Truth Haven, I'm not Holly, am I? Uh-huh. She said, Dee Dee can do things that Holly cannot.
Nice moral out, isn't it?
Ash tried not to grin.
I think I like Dee Dee more.
Yes, I think you do. But Holly is more complete. Holly is happy and understands the truth.
Dee Dee.
Then pausing, he sighed and said, or should I say Holly? This exit. He took it.
What, Ash?
Can I be blunt?
Yes.
How can you believe this crap?
He glanced at her.
She tucked her legs up so that she was sitting cross-legged in the seat.
I really do love you, Ash.
I love you, too.
You did some Googling, Ash, on the Shining Truth?
He had. Their leader, Caspar Vartage, was born of a mysterious birth in 1942. His mother claimed to have woken up one day 7 months pregnant, the very moment her husband died leading the charge on Normandy Beach. There is no proof of any of this, of course, but this is the story. As a youngster in Nebraska, Caspar was considered a grain healer, and farmers sought him out during droughts and the like. Again, no one backs up this claim. Vartage rebelled against his powers, something about the truth being so potent he tried to fight it off, and ended up in prison sometime around 1970 for fraud. That part, the fraud, there is evidence of, and plenty of it. After losing an eye in a prison fight and being thrown into a hellhole described as the heat box, old Caspar was visited by an angel. Hard to say if Vartage just made this part up out of whole cloth, or if the sun caused delusions. Either way, the angel who visited him is known in the cult's clever folklore as the Visitor. The Visitor told him about the truth and the symbol he had to find behind a rock in the Arizona desert when he was free, which, supposedly, he did. There was more crap like that, typical nonsense mythology, and now the Shining Truth had a compound where they brainwashed disciples, mostly women, or beat, or drugged, or raped them.
I don't expect you to see the truth, Dee Dee said.
I just don't get how you don't see this as a crazy-ass cult.
She angled her body toward him. Do you remember Mrs. Kensington? Mrs. Kensington, a foster mother they'd had in common, took those in her care to church twice a week, Tuesday afternoons for Bible studies and Sunday mornings for Mass. Always. She never missed them.
Of course you do.
She was good to us, he agreed.
Yes, she was. Do you still go to church, Ash?
Rarely, he said.
You liked it, though, when we were kids.
It was quiet. I liked the quiet.
Do you remember the stories that we heard back then?
Sure.
Mrs. Kensington believed every one of them.
I know.
So remind me, how old was Noah when he built the ark?
Dee Dee.
Somewhere around 500 years old, if I recall. Do you really think Noah put two of every creature on that ark? There are a million types of insects alone. Think he managed to get them all on board? That all makes sense to you and all the Mrs. Kensingtons out there. But the truth doesn't?
It's not the same thing.
Sure it is. We sat in that church and Mrs. Kensington had tears in her eyes and nodded when they told us about salvation. Do you remember the stories?
Ash frowned.
Let me see if I can recap. A celestial baby boy, who was his own father, was born to a married virgin. Then the baby's father, who was also him, tortured and killed him. Oh, but then he came back from the dead like a zombie. But if you eat his flesh, which is a wafer, and drink his wine blood and promise to kiss his ass, he will suck all the evil out of you.
Dee Dee,
wait, I'm getting to the best part. The reason why there is evil at all in the world. Do you remember this part, Ash?
He did, but he kept quiet.
No?
Oh,
you'll love this. Evil exists because an airheaded bimbo who started life as a man's rib got tricked into eating a piece of bad fruit by a talking reptile.
Dee Dee clapped her hands together and fell back on the car seat laughing.
Do I need to go into the other stuff?
The parting of the seas,
the prophets ascending on animals up to the sky, Abraham pimping out his wife to the Pharaoh. How about even now, all these holy men who live in Roman compounds with homoerotic art and wear costumes that would make a drag queen blush?
He just kept on driving.
Ash.
What?
It may sound like I'm mocking these beliefs, she said, or that I'm mocking Mrs. Kensington.
That it does.
I'm not. My point is, maybe before you dismiss other beliefs as wacko, you should take a closer look at the stories that normal, Dee Dee air quoted, people find credible. We think all religions are crazy, except our own.
He didn't want to admit it, but she had a point. And yet, something in her tone.
The truth is more than a religion. It's a living, breathing entity. The truth has always existed. It will always exist. Most people's God lives in the past, thousands of years ago, stuck in old books. Why? Do they think God gave up on them? Mine is here, today, in the real world. When this truth dies, his offspring will continue, because the truth lives. The truth, if you could be objective, Ash. If you hadn't been brainwashed by the big religions since childbirth, makes more sense than talking snakes or elephant gods, doesn't it?
Ash said nothing.
Ash!
What?
Talk to me.
I don't know what to say.
Maybe that's because you're hearing the truth.
No, that's not it.
Take your next right, she said. We're getting close.
The road was one lane now, with forest on either side.
You don't have to go back, Ash said.
Dee Dee turned and stared out her window.
I have some money saved, Ash continued.
We could go somewhere. Just you and me, buy a place. You could be Holly with me.
She didn't reply.
Dee?
Yes.
Did you hear me?
I did.
You don't have to go back.
Shh. We're getting close now.
Chapter 21 Simon called the phone number on Professor Vanderbeek's bio page. After two rings, it went to voicemail. Simon left a message asking Vanderbeek to call him back about his daughter, Paige Green. Simon doubled up then, sending an email to the professor with the same request. He called both Sam and Anya, but the calls went right into voicemail, which was no surprise. Kids never talked on the phone, only texted. He should have known better. He sent them both the same text. You okay? Wanna call me? Sam answered right away. All good. Nah, no need. Again, no surprise. He started back toward New York City. He and Ingrid shared a stream or a cloud or whatever, so that all his photos and documents and all her photos and documents were in the same place. Music, too. They shared a service, so he told Siri to play Ingrid's most recent playlist and sat back and listened. The first song Ingrid had put on her playlist made him smile. The Girl from Ipanema, the 1964 version sung by Astrid Gilberto. Sublime. Simon shook his head, still in awe of the woman who had somehow, out of all the options, chosen him. Him. Whatever life had thrown at him, whatever turns he'd made or bizarre forks he'd seen in the road, that fact, that Ingrid had chosen him, always kept him balanced, made him thankful, guided him home. The phone rang. The caller ID appeared on the car's navigation screen. Yvonne. He quickly answered it.
It's not about Ingrid, Yvonne said right away. No change there.
What then?
And nothing is wrong.
Okay.
Today's the second Tuesday of the month, she said.
He'd forgotten about Sadie Lowenstein.
Not a big deal, Yvonne continued. I can call Sadie for you and postpone, or I can head out myself, or...
No, I'll go.
Simon, no, I want to. It's on my way anyhow.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
If something changes with Ingrid, I'll call you. Or Robert will. He's taking over for me soon.
How are the kids?
Anya is with your neighbor. Sam is on his phone all the time, texting or whatever.
He started dating a girl 2 weeks ago. Did you know that?
Another pang, though a small one this time.
No. The girlfriend wants to come down from Amherst and sit here with him, which is making him smile in spite of himself, but Sam's told her not to yet.
I'll be back soon.
They miss you, but they don't need you, if you know what I mean. They get what you're doing.
Sadie Lowenstein lived in a brick colonial in Yonkers, New York, just north of the Bronx. The neighborhood was no frills and working class. Sadie had lived here for 57 of her 83 years. She could afford better. As her financial advisor, Simon knew that better than anyone. She could get a place down in Florida for the rough winters, too, a condo maybe, but she scoffed. No interest. She took 2 trips per year to Vegas. That was it. Other than that, she liked her old home. Sadie still smoked and had the raspy voice to prove it. She wore an old-school house-dress muumuu. They sat in her kitchen at the round formica table where Sadie once sat with her husband Frank and their twin boys Barry and Greg. They were gone from here now. Barry died of AIDS in 1992. Frank succumbed to cancer in 2004. Greg, the only one still living, had moved out to Phoenix and rarely came home to visit. The floor was filmy linoleum. A clock above the sink had the numbers displayed with red dice, a souvenir from one of her early Vegas trips with Frank, maybe 20 years ago.
"Sit," Sadie said. "I'll make you some of that tea you like so much."
The tea was a store-brand chamomile with lemon and honey. He didn't drink tea. For Simon, tea was weak, a coffee wannabe, and much as he wanted tea to be something more, tea always ended up being little more than brown water.
But a decade ago, maybe more, he couldn't remember anymore, Sadie had made him tea with this particular flavor bought at this particular store, and she'd asked him if he liked it, and he said, "Very much." And now that tea was here, waiting for him every time he visited.
"It's hot, so be careful."
A monthly calendar, the kind with generic photographs of mountains and rivers, hung on the ivory-to-yellow refrigerator. Banks used to hand out calendars like these for free. Maybe Banks still did that. Sadie was getting them somewhere. Simon stared at the calendar, that simple old-world scheduler and to-do list. He did that pretty much every time he came, just stared at the 30 or 31 boxes. Yes, 28 or 29 in February for the anal. Most, almost all of those boxes had no writing in them, just white. A blue ballpoint had scratched out the words, "Dentist, 2 p.m. for the 6th of the month. Recycling day was circled every other Monday. And there, on the second Tuesday of every month, written with a purple marker in big, bold letters was one word. Simon! Yes, his name. With the exclamation point. And an exclamation point was really not Sadie Lowenstein. That was it. He had first seen that calendar entry, his name in purple with an exclamation point, on this same refrigerator 8 years ago, when he was debating cutting down his visits because really, at this stage, with her investments and costs pretty much fixed, there was no reason to come out monthly. It could be handled by phone or by a junior colleague, or at the most, they could wrap it up in quarterly visits. But then Simon looked at the refrigerator and saw his name on the calendar. He told Ingrid about the entry. He told Yvonne about it. Sadie had no family nearby anymore. Her friends had either moved or passed away, so this meant something to her, his visits, sitting at the old kitchen table where she once raised a family. Simon going over the portfolio as they both sipped tea. And so, it meant something to him, too. Simon had never missed an appointment with Sadie, not once. Ingrid would be angry if he'd canceled today. So, here he was. He was able to access her portfolio from his laptop. He went over a few of the holdings, but really,
That was all beside the point.
Simon, do you remember our old store?
Sadie and Frank had owned a small office supply store in town, the kind of place that sold pens and paper and made photocopies and business cards.
Sure, he said.
Have you driven by it lately?
No, it's a clothing store now, right?
Used to be. All those tight teen clothes. I used to call it Sluts R Us, remember?
I remember.
Which I know isn't nice. I mean, you should have seen me in my prime. I was a looker, Simon.
You still are.
She waved a dismissive hand at him.
Stop with the patronizing. Back then, though, boy, I knew how to use my curves, if you know what I'm saying. My dad would throw a fit with what I wore.
A wistful smile came to her lips.
Got Frank's attention, that I can tell you. The poor kid. Saw me at Rockaway Beach in a two-piece. Ah, he never had a chance.
She turned the smile toward him. He smiled back.
Anyway, Sadie said, a smile and the memory vanishing. That whore costume place closed down. Now it's a restaurant. Guess what kind of food?
What kind? She took a drag from her cigarette and made a face like a dog had left a dropping on her linoleum.
Asian fusion, she spat out.
Oh.
What the hell does that even mean? Is fusion a country now?
I'm not sure.
Asian fusion. And it's called Mishigas.
Yeah? I don't think that's the name.
Something like that. Trying to appeal to us tribe members, right?
She shook her head.
Asian fusion? I mean, come on, Simon.
She sighed and toyed with a cigarette.
So what's wrong?
Pardon?
With you. What's wrong?
Nothing.
You think I'm Meshuggah?
Are you speaking fusion to me?
Very funny. I could tell the moment you walked in. What's wrong?
It's a long story. She leaned back, looked left, looked right, looked back at him.
You think I got a lot going on right now?
He almost told her. Sadie looked at him with wisdom and sympathy, and she clearly welcomed it, would probably even enjoy, if that was the word, listening with a learned ear and offering, at the very least, moral support. But he didn't. It wasn't about his own privacy. It was about the line. Simon was her financial advisor. He could exchange niceties about his family, but not something like this. His issues were his issues, not his clients.
Something with one of your children, Sadie said.
What makes you say that?
When you lose a child, Sadie said.
She stopped, shrugged.
One of the side effects is this kind of sixth sense. Plus, I mean, what else would it be? Okay, so which kid?
Easier to just say it. My oldest.
Paige. I won't pry.
You're not prying.
May I give you a little advice, Simon?
Sure.
I mean, that's what you do, right? Give advice. You come here and you give me financial advice because you're an expert in money. My expertise is, anyway, I always knew Barry was gay. It was strange. Identical twins raised in the same house. Barry used to sit right where you are. That was his seat. Greg sat next to him. But from as young as I can remember, they were different. It gets everyone mad when I say that Barry from day one was, I don't know, more flamboyant. That doesn't mean you're gay, people tell me, but I know my truth. My boys were identical and different. If you knew them both, even as little children, and had to guess which was gay, go ahead, Sam stereotyping, you'd know. Barry was into fashion and theater. Greg was into baseball and cars. I mean, I was practically raising cliches.
She tried to smile at that. Simon folded his hands and put them on the kitchen table. He had heard some of this before, but that wasn't a place Sadie went to very often. And that was when it began to dawn on him. The twins. Genetics.
The story of Barry and Greg had fascinated him the first time he'd heard it, because he'd wondered how identical twins, who had the exact same DNA and were raised in the same home, ended up with different sexual preferences.
"When Barry got sick," Sadie continued, "we didn't see what it was doing to Greg. We ignored him. We had to deal with all the immediate horror. Meanwhile, Greg is seeing his identical twin wither away. There's no reason to go into details, but Greg never recovered from Barry's illness. He was scared, so he just ran away. I didn't see that in time."
Greg was the only beneficiary of his mother's estate, so Simon still kept somewhat in touch with him. Greg was now thrice divorced and currently engaged to a 28-year-old dancer he'd met in Reno.
"I lost him because I didn't pay attention. But also..."
She stopped. "Also what?"
"Because I couldn't save Barry. That was really it, Simon. For all the problems, all Greg's fears of maybe being gay too, all that. If I could have saved Barry, Greg would have been okay."
She tilted her head.
"Can you still save Paige?"
"I don't know."
"But there's a chance?"
"Yeah, there is. Genetics." Paige had been studying genetics.
"Then go save her, Simon."
Chapter 22. There were no signs for Truth Haven, which was hardly a surprise.
"Take a left," Dee Dee said, "by that old mailbox."
Old was an understatement. The mailbox looked as if passing teenagers had started whacking it daily with a baseball bat during the Carter administration. Dee Dee looked at his face.
"What?"
"Something else I read," Ash said.
"What?"
"Are you forced to have sex with them?"
"With?"
"You know what I mean. Your truth or your visitor or whatever the leaders call themselves." She said nothing. "I read that they force you." Her voice was soft.
"The truth can't be forced."
"Sounds like a yes."
"Genesis 19:32," she said.
"What?"
"Do you remember the story of Lot in the Bible?"
"Seriously,
do you remember the story or not?"
This sounded to him like a deflection, but he answered, "Vaguely."
"So in Genesis chapter 19, God allows Lot and his wife and their two daughters to escape the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah."
He nodded. "But Lot's wife turns around when she's not supposed to."
"Right. And God turns her into a pillar of salt, which is, well, seriously messed up, but that's not my point. It's Lot's daughters."
"What about them?"
"When they get to Zoar, Lot's daughters complain there are no men, so they come up with a plan."
"Do you remember what it is?"
"No." "The older daughter tells her younger sister," I'm quoting Genesis 19:32, "come on, let's get our father drunk so that we can sleep with him and have children by him."
Ash said nothing.
"And they do. Yep, incest, right there in Genesis. The two daughters get their father drunk, sleep with him, and become pregnant."
"I thought the truth had nothing to do with the Old or New Testament."
"We don't. So why are you using Lot as an excuse?" "I don't need an excuse, Ash. And I don't need your permission. I just need the truth."
He kept staring out the front windshield. "That still sounds like a yes, I have sex with them."
"Do you like sex, Ash?"
"Yes."
"So if you were in a group where you got to have sex with a lot of women, would it be an issue?"
He didn't reply. The car tires kicked up dirt from the road as he headed into the woods. No trespassing signs, a wide variety of them in various colors and sizes and even wording, hung from trees. As they approached the gate, Dee Dee rolled down her window and made a complicated hand gesture like a third base coach signaling a runner to steal second. The car glided to a stop before the gate. Dee Dee opened her car door. When Ash did the same, she stopped him, with a hand on his shoulder and a shake of her head.
"Stay here.
Keep both hands on the steering wheel at all times. Don't take them off, even to scratch your nose. Two men in gray uniforms that reminded Ash of a Civil War reenactment appeared from the small guardhouse. They were both armed with AR-15s. They both had huge beards and scowled at Ash.